Today, we're speaking with Marlon Sherman. Marlon is a professor and department chair of Native American Studies at Humboldt State University. He specializes in indigenous and tribal law, justice, peacemaking, governance, environment, resource use, culture, history, and philosophy. Welcome, Marlon.
Thank you for having me.
Your specialty is indigenous and tribal law, and I think there's a lot of confusion in the general public about tribal law and treaties. How do you approach this topic with your students?
Well, one of the first things that I tell them is that there is an area of law, and it's called federal Indian law. Federal Indian law is the area that pertains to all tribes in the United States. And American Indian tribes, and I'm using the term American Indian because that's the federal term right now, but American Indian tribes in the United States have probably the largest collection of laws pertaining to any group of people in the United States. No other group of people, racial or ethnic, has such a large body of law pertaining to them. And it's all contained in the United States Code. You can find it up in the library, in the stacks, or online. The U.S. Code in the 25th volume. The entire volume is devoted to American Indians. Now, in addition to that, there are years and years of Supreme Court cases that have also defined federal Indian law. So there are congressional acts, statutes, and then there are Supreme Court decisions, and those all define what this body of federal Indian law looks like. And so there is a lot of law out there. The problem with federal Indian law is that when I start teaching it in class, people get this confused look on their faces. I start talking about certain things and they stare at me and their brows go up and they shake their heads, and they pretty soon somebody says, "This is really confusing." And I say, "Now you get the point. Federal Indian law is very confusing. And anybody who says it's not is lying to you. It's illogical. Much of it is made up basically on the fly, based on what a particular Supreme Court justice feels is right within that time period. So when people ask me about federal Indian law, that's my first explanation of it, is that I'm going to try to explain it to you and it's not going to make any sense. So just bear with me for a while.
Are these federal Indian laws, are they honored and enforced?
Some of them are enforced religiously. Some of them are not enforced at all. For instance, there's a body of law that says that tribes have superior water rights to everybody else because they were here first. In fact, there was a case up in Oregon, the Klamath tribes up in Oregon, where the Supreme Court said that they had water rights all the way back to time immemorial, and therefore superior to everybody else's. But those laws are very seldom enforced, and so often water is taken from tribes that they should have access to based on that principle of time immemorial. Water is taken by the federal government or by private parties, and tribes often have no legal recourse. They may sue, but often they will lose. It's an interesting body of law, and there are areas like this in other bodies of law as well, civil rights, for instance, or some criminal laws that are selectively enforced or not enforced at all. And yes, that's the case with the federal Indian law as well.
So if it's the law for the tribes on the Klamath in Oregon to have rights to the water, how can that not be enforced? How is a federal law ignored in that way?
Well, just as a for instance, many people have heard about the fish kill on the Klamath River back in 2002. The Bureau of Reclamation recognized that under the Endangered Species Act, which is not a federal Indian law, but under the Endangered Species Act, that the fish were endangered, the salmon, because of a drought. It was a drought year, and so they cut off the farmers' water supply in the upper basin. Farmers had a big reaction to that, and a very political reaction, and they basically trespassed on federal property. They stole federal water, and nothing was ever done to them. And so the next year, throughout that year, they lobbied Congress, they lobbied the administration. It happened to be the George Bush administration. And so they lobbied that administration, and they were able to get Dick Cheney on their side. And it was Dick Cheney who came out and oversaw this the next year. So this all happened in 2001. Then in 2002, Dick Cheney came out and oversaw the release of water to the farms and the fields, taking water away from the salmon. And so because there was so little water, and what water there was warm, and it was a breeding place for bacteria and other things, and that's when the fish got sick in that warm, toxic water and died by the thousands and thousands, as many as 80 or 100,000. Nobody's quite sure exactly how many, but it was a tremendous death of fish. And under the law of the year before, the water should have stayed in the Klamath River, but it didn't because it was superseded by political action at the top levels of the Bush administration. And so that's generally how things work. The same thing is happening now. President Obama created the Bear's Ears. This was done in Utah. And that whole area was supposed to be set aside from mining and other exploitative activities and opened only to recreational hiking use and those kinds of things. And as soon as the orange one came into power, he actually himself changed that ruling, Obama's ruling, and opened up that site, all of those millions of acres, to mining and oil exploration.
I've read a bit about that. I wanted to ask you, too, about the Dakota Access Pipeline and how two presidents, not just the orange one, as you say, but also President Obama, were complicit in the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And with all of the thousands of people who came out to stand against it, you know, all of the rights of the tribe, how was it that protest was not successful in stopping the flow of oil through that pipeline?
Right. First of all, for those who are not familiar with it, the Dakota Access Pipeline was originally supposed to go from northwestern North Dakota north and then follow a route which would take it north of Bismarck and then down into South Dakota. But the people in Bismarck, the city fathers, decided that it would be unhealthy to have an oil pipeline running north of their town. They were afraid there was a possibility of leakage and it would ruin their drinking water. So they convinced the Army Corps of Engineers to move that pipeline route south, far south of Bismarck. The problem is that it was then directly north of the Standing Rock Reservation. Now, Standing Rock are Lakota people, and they signed a treaty back in 1868 with the federal government, and they have never re-signed, they had never released any of that land willingly, and yet the United States illegally took land all around the current reservation for their own purposes and resold it, basically. Not only that, many of these people in Standing Rock and in their neighboring reservation, Cheyenne River, are river people. They're Lakota, but they didn't spend all of their lives hunting the buffalo. That's the stereotype, but it's also true.
You're an Ogallala Lakota. Right?
I am, yeah. Yes. And my mother was from the Cheyenne River Reservation, just south of Standing Rock. So I know this story personally, but those Lakota people were actually farmers. They farmed in the river valley, the Missouri River Valley. They had farmed there for a long, long time. They raised corn, they raised the various crops. And they plant their corn, take care of it, and then at some point they would go out and bring back enough buffalo and other protein for the winter needs. But that was prime agricultural land, really good loam. And the United States took that land in spite of the treaty that they had signed in 1868. They took that land, they took the river, dammed it, and that reservoir then covered up all of that former Lakota farming land. So they had to move out into the plains up in higher prairie there, which is not good for farming, and it's cold and it's windy. And this happened both with the Cheyenne River as well as the Standing Rock people. So they all got forced out of their original homelands up into the higher country, the higher plains. So when the Dakota Access Pipeline process moved down just directly north of the reservation, the Standing Rock people protested. They said, we have environmental concerns and this should not be here. But in spite of all that, even while their illegal protest was going on, they were protesting it administratively and in the courts, Dakota Access was still building their pipeline along that new route to the northern part of the reservation. They never stopped building it. They assumed that it was going to be built where they wanted it to be built. And so the people then tried to stop it by extra administrative means. I mean, you know, they formed those camps out. They started living in those camps out there and protesting in different ways. They were all peaceful protests for the most part. But what that showed was that the power of corporations to pervert the police and the military process for their own ends, because military equipment was used to keep track of the protesters' movements during the day and at night as well. There were constantly helicopters and drones flying over the camps, and as well as they erected spotlights all around that area there, you know, running 24 hours a day.
There was a plane that just circled around the camp as well, and people's cell phones stopped working.
Yes.
And, yeah.
They jammed the phones.
Mm-hmm. That happened to me, actually. Yeah. And a lot of people there.
So, yes. And so it became fairly obvious fairly quickly that corporations were able to supersede any law that existed. The law, of course, it's a very basic law that says that treaties are the supreme law of the land. The U.S. Constitution itself says that treaties are the supreme law of the land, and yet the United States is consistently ignoring those treaties with the tribes. In this case, in Standing Rock, they ignored that treaty of 1868 and built that pipeline right near the reservation in spite of the protests that, by the way, were the same protests that the city of Bismarck had.
Right.
And yet they were able to get it moved.
So, Marlon, you talk about something called cooperative autonomy. Is that a concept that you came up with, and what is it?
Oh, it's just something I've been kicking around for a while. Tribes often depend on a term called tribal sovereignty, and it's a real buzzword among tribes, and people say it all the time now. Native peoples, they say, oh, you know, we have tribal sovereignty. We can make our own laws. We have tribal sovereignty. We can have our own economy. And they say, don't tell us what to do. You, the state of California, you can't tax us. We have tribal sovereignty. You can't sue us. We have tribal sovereignty. And it's a catch-all, and it's very handy. My problem is with that term of tribal sovereignty and with the actuality of it is that it's a European construct. It comes from Europe. It comes directly from Europe. When you talk about sovereignty, you're talking about kings and queens. You're talking about sovereigns. The majority of Native nations do not have sovereigns. There were exceptions, sure. But the majority of the indigenous people who are working and worshiping with the ground and the sky, the creators, did not practice any form of sovereignty. Most of what they did was cooperative, consensual living styles and governing styles. And men and women had pretty much equal roles in different ways. It may have seemed unequal to European eyes, and it may still seem unequal. But in so many places, women were a part of the government that the explorers and the anthropologists, they could not see it because they weren't watching for it. They worked cooperatively. And that's the way that tribal governments should be running. Instead, right now, tribal governments are based on a winner-takes-all vote. Just like the United States, everybody votes on their leaders, and the majority wins. So that means that the minority is not going to be very happy with the person who gets into office. What should be happening is that both sides should be electing their leader if they want it that way. If they want to still elect a leader, then they should have dual leaders or three leaders who work cooperatively towards satisfying their constituents' needs instead of having one tribal council chairperson or president. Now, it's true there are tribal councils, but that also is an American construct. The U.S. government placed that system of tribal councils on tribes back in 1934. They said, this is the way you're going to be operating from now on. And they said very politely, we suggest that you operate this way. And then they held the knife to their throats and said, this is the better way for you to be operating. Please do it that way. So it was a very strong suggestion that everybody have tribal councils, and most do now. Some of them have what they're called business councils. Some have what are called general councils, but everybody has that concept. Technically, it should work, except the tribal council members are also voted in by that majority wins rule. And so there's an entire group of people, generally speaking, in tribes that have no representation. That's something that I've thought about, and it's not that hard to create a system that is cooperative, where people cooperate in designing their own solutions instead of waiting for somebody to bring it down from on high and then place it on top of them.
How would a cooperative autonomy function, say, in a tribal community here?
Probably we'd have to work with the young people. And I see some really great young folks locally here that have done some really wonderful things. And if you talk about Standing Rock, by the way, that whole idea, the Standing Rock protest, was started by youth, by teenagers. So, you know, that makes me hopeful. But that's where we need to start is for us old folks, if we have any influence in the community, in the society, then to sort of push the society, the community, toward teaching the young ones right principles of living. Now, as Vine Deloria Jr. said, this whole country is a rights country. Everybody's concerned about their individual rights. Vine said that we need to be more concerned about responsibilities. We should move from being a rights country to being a responsibility country. And that's the essence of a cooperative existence, is taking responsibility for other people and not being so concerned about your first, second, third, fourth amendment rights. Worry not about my rights to speak, my rights to own a gun, but about somebody else's rights to be safe and to feel safe and not to be harassed. And so that's probably the most important thing that right now that we could teach youngsters is how to be responsible for each other. And they already do that. You know, little babies will share with you. The first thing, if they have something unique, they'll give it to you just because they want to. They already know it. It's our fault that they lose that giving ability. So that's where we would start. And then over time, create a set of laws that looks more like something that's concerned about people than about persons, individual persons. And that's going to be hard. I mean, look at how many volumes and reams and encyclopedias full of law. So it's not going to be easy. But on the other hand, I take the long view. I figure that it's taken us 500 years to get where we are now. And so that's one of the main reasons that I talk about autonomy. We can't be depending on the political actors in this country. We cannot. They're in it for themselves. They are the epitome of the individualist, rights-oriented politician. And we need then, therefore, to move away from that into a more autonomous way of living. If you look throughout California, there were no large or few large so-called tribes. Most of them were smaller units, autonomous communities along the rivers. They usually based themselves in their villages, and that's how they named themselves, was by their villages. And I understand that right now, in the moment, we need to protect ourselves according to the existing laws. Okay, so we need lawyers to deal with the courts. We need to lobby Congress to try to, you know, to at least not kill us, not destroy us completely.
Right. Or so, file injunctions, sure, with the Bureau of Reclamation so
absolutely
that they'll release more water into the Klamath River. I mean,
absolutely.
Thank God that the Hupa tribe and the Yurok tribes are actually working on behalf of the fish and the rivers, because we all benefit from those efforts.
That's right. And I look upon those as holding actions. I look upon those as flanking actions to take care of our flank so that the real work can continue inside the community. That we need warriors out there, outside our boundaries, to keep the regular people safe. so that they can begin to work cooperatively within their own particular indigenous community, and make it more like it used to be, but include some technology and Levi's, please.
That seems reasonable.
One thing that I always tell students on the last day of class, I know that you won't remember 98% of what I've talked about in this class or 98% of what you've read. If you carry away one thing, take away this, and that is to please respect each other. Please treat each other with respect. Act as if you do respect somebody, even if you don't. At least give them a modicum, a little bit of respect, and allow them to believe what they believe unless it's harmful to someone and you can see that it's harmful. Otherwise, respect their beliefs, listen to them, converse rather than argue. Respect.
That's a good thing to take away. Well, all right. Thank you so much, Marlon Sherman from the Native American Studies Department at HSU. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.